Welcome to the UBS Forum at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer. We have a full house with a lot of people in attendance to talk about a quintessential Minnesota topic, the weather, specifically stormy weather. In a typical year, numerous thunderstorms rumbled across the Minnesota landscape, some hitting the threshold of being labeled severe storms with potentially devastating winds, hail, and dangerous lightning. Minnesota is also no stranger to one of Mother Nature's fiercest storms, tornadoes. In an average year, we may see about 26 twisters. Because the severe weather season is just starting in our region, we wanted to talk about storms, what to do to protect yourself and your property, advances in storm detection, and we'll swap personal stories about surviving some of the worst that nature can dish out. With us are several experts with years of experience watching the weather. We'll start with the home team. Minnesota Public Radio Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner is here. University of Minnesota climatologist and Morning Edition weather commentator Mark Seeley is with us, too. In the audience, Minnesota Public Radio meteorologist Craig Edwards. Our special panelist is well-known broadcast meteorologist Paul Douglas. We also have experts sprinkled throughout the audience, and we will hear from them as well. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Kathy. Thanks.
Hey, why are we in such a fruitful area for severe weather?
A function of geography. We're blessed or cursed that way, I guess, however you want to look at it. Go 1,500 miles to the north, and it's the Arctic Circle. 1,500 miles to the south, the Gulf of Mexico, a huge moisture source. Cold air from the Arctic Circle, and literally no barriers between the two to prevent these air masses from sweeping into Minnesota. This is where they collide, and when they do, severe weather happens.
This is a playground for different air masses. They all converge. And I tell people we don't live in Tornado Alley, which runs from Texas to about southern Iowa. We do, however, live in Tornado Cul-de-sac. We get our fair share. And there's still a lot of otherwise God-fearing, rational, intelligent Minnesotans walking around thinking that just because they live in a city or a close-in suburb, that somehow they are immune from tornadoes. And that just continues to baffle my mind to this day.
Mark Seeley, what about the climatology of our area?
Well, in addition to a place of convergence for all these air masses, we're an extremely diverse landscape. And that has a little role to play as well, because the way that landscape handles radiation, that is the energy from the sun, as well as it manifests itself by emitting heat and water vapor into the overlying air. There's a huge difference across our landscape. We have the heavily forested area, we have the prairie grassland area to the west, and then we have the mixed deciduous and the topographic landscape down here in southeastern Minnesota. So I think there's some landscape features that are associated with this playground area, too.
Say, how early can we usually see severe weather around here?
March 18th is our first documented, recorded tornado. We also have had tornadoes as late as the first week of November. But unlike some of the Midwestern states to our east that have seen literally tornado occurrences in every month of the year, we've never seen one in December, January, or February.
That's a good thing. We see other things, of course.
Yeah, that's right.
We get other things.
Yes, yeah. We do.
Yeah. Prime time is June. Number two is what, May?
Yeah.
And peak hour, right around the dinner hour, although it's the tornadoes that occur late at night that cause a disproportionate number of injuries, fatalities. People just aren't tuned into the weather the way they are during the daylight hours.
Is it just me? Are we seeing more severe weather, say, around September? Thinking about the Rogers tornado.
There's a secondary maxima.
It is. Indeed, there's a little peak in as the cold air masses start to come south in the fall again. So September, there's a little secondary severe weather peak, and we've seen that in recent years. Rogers, the Andover storm, I think it was 2005 in September. It happens in September as well.
That's
absolutely.
Paul Huttner. Say, Paul Douglas, and I toss this your way because I know you have some pretty strong feelings on this. Are we seeing more severe weather because of global warming?
How much time do you have, Ms. Werzer? That's still open to debate. The number one greenhouse gas, of course, is water vapor. And as you warm up the atmosphere, even by a degree or two, theoretically you increase the capacity for water vapor. Recently, a study was done 1948 to 2005. It showed a 33% spike in extreme weather events, flash floods, large hail. Especially on the flooding side, I think you can probably connect the dots and reach that conclusion. It becomes much more difficult to say, yes, we're seeing more tornadoes, more hailstorms. There's a considerable body of evidence that we're doing a much better job finding severe thunderstorms. Thanks to the professionals at Skywarn, Americans are more storm literate than they were 20, 30, 50 years ago. More people with video cameras. What was farmland 30 years ago, now subdivision. So I think you simply have more people out looking for severe weather than ever before. And so there is some debate among meteorologists. Are we really seeing an uptick, or are we just doing a better job finding what has always been there?
Dr. Seeley?
I would take that and amplify it one bit further with geographic consideration. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their 2007 report, which was the fourth assessment, clearly documented that at some landscape positions in the polar or subpolar regions, especially in the northern hemisphere, they are seeing a higher frequency of severe weather, convective severe weather. So this includes flash floods, severe thunderstorms, tornadoes. And, for example, Manitoba had its first F5, first ever documented F5. Tornado occurrences and thunderstorms in Alaska are reported as increasing in frequency, as they are in terms of severe thunderstorms in the Scandinavian high-latitude countries of Western Europe. So the IPCC is suggesting there is something, the door has opened with climate change, for the higher latitude positions to be exposed to more severe weather. The depth of the atmosphere, the depth of the troposphere as we know it, is getting deeper in the high latitude positions. And so we're seeing more vertical cloud development. That's one feature that they highlight in the report.
Kathy, last year 18 tornadoes in Minnesota, fewer than usual, and most of them were in northwestern Minnesota. We're seeing more tornadoes up in Roseau and Halleck, up in the north woods of northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin. Siren, a perfect example, an F3 tornado. So, again, it certainly seems like the zone is shifting northward along with the climate zone. The fact that we are now in climate zone 5, you know, for the longest time, weren't we in climate zone 4? Everything has shifted north about 150, 160 miles. Mm-hmm. According to the venerable Wall Street Journal, that's where I read it. In 16 years, 150 miles.
We're in the UBS Forum talking about severe weather, and we have a full house with us, a lot of audience members, so I'm going to go over into the audience here. Your name?
Wendy Nelson.
Hi, nice to meet you here. What's your question?
I'm more paranoid about the weather now. I do think things have changed. I've lived 50 years of my life here, and I used to be able to count on certain things kind of to happen at certain times of year, and it's getting a little more erratic. But my one question you may or may not be able to help me with is that I live in a split level. My friend Jan and I, we've been weather spotters for 7 years, and we go to these classes. And as far as taking shelter, going to the staircase, if you have a split level, west exposed, she went to the Skywarn workshop, and a guy pretty much said, that's probably the worst kind of structure to be in a tornado. Is there any way to reinforce under the stairs if that's all you've got?
We just had a guest on from Texas Tech where they do on a jet streaming, our podcast that Kathy and I and Mark do every week. And the trend is for these reinforced tornado-proof rooms in homes. There are actually places that you can go search on the internet to try to find these. I also saw something interesting when I was in Oklahoma, and this probably would not apply, but they now have these steel case shelters that sit out in front like of the Fleet Farm or whatever, and you can dig them into the ground, and they have a little trap door. That might be a little extreme for your situation, but really what you want to do is put as many walls as possible between you and the outside, and under the stairs is an excellent place to do that. There have been a lot of F4, F5 tornadoes that have completely cleaned off a foundation, and under the stairs is one of those safer places.
Or a bathtub. Many people have survived F4, F5 twisters They're in their bathtub with pillows and blankets on top of them. And you look at the aerial surveys from above, and there's nothing left. And F5, as Paul said, scours a home right down to the foundation. Even a well-built stone brick home, nothing left but foundation. And many people have survived in their bathtubs because of the plumbing, the pipes. The bathtub is the last thing to go. It's hard getting a family of five. But you'd be amazed. If there's a tornado coming, you might just be able to do it.
While we're on the subject of safety, I did get an email from an individual, a storm spotter, who was concerned about people on highways driving if there's severe weather. It may be a tornado. I always thought, and I've seen video of this.
They did the wrong thing.
Really? When you get out of the car and run underneath a bridge,
right.
That's not safe?
They got lucky.
Yeah, it actually has a wind tunnel effect. It will actually accelerate the wind and increase your odds of being hit by flying debris. The tornado isn't going to kill you. It's what's in the tornado. It's being hit on the head, blunt force trauma, a tiny pebble traveling at 150 miles an hour. That is what causes the problem. So you're safer going into the ditch. If you can't get into a building in time, if you can't outrun the tornado, get out of your vehicle. Don't go under the vehicle. For goodness sakes, don't stay in the vehicle. I think the ditch is still statistically the safest place to be. Do not go underneath the bridge overpass.
We have four Skywarn spotters with us. John, you're with you're the Skywarn coordinator for the Twin Cities.
Well, I'm chairman of the operations committee for Metro Skywarn, and then I'm Nick's backup net control operator. So we're the people that essentially hear the reports from the spotters in the field. And that is one of the things, one of the very first things that we hit is spotter safety. And that same rule applies to everybody who is out there. Even if you're not a spotter, if you're on the highway and you see a storm coming and you see hail, the immediate urge is to find your nearest overpass and to get your car underneath it. Or if you're on a motorcycle, to get underneath that thing as fast as possible. Now, the hail is dangerous. There's no doubt about that. But being under an overpass is even more dangerous. And the other thing you have to worry about, especially in urban areas, is urban flooding. Oftentimes, those intersections will flood very rapidly, and more people are killed because of flooding than anything else. So it's very important to keep that safety measure in mind.
So the video that we've seen, that fabulous video where the camera crew is underneath the overpass and you see that tornado come right through, they were just lucky.
As Paul said, they were extraordinarily lucky.
Okay.
And that particular case in Kansas, I think that was part of the Andover outbreak, the tornado did not pass directly above them. It came very close, but it just missed their location. But yes, that has been replayed millions of times, and it does give off the wrong message.
Hey, another question from an audience member. Hello.
Hi, my name is Al from New Brighton, and I was really reminded of the need to get into a small interior room a few years back. I was helping relatives clean up from straight-line winds that came through. There was a wind turbine across the street that maxed out their anemometer at 135 miles an hour, and they had a pole barn for their electrical business, and it was entirely wiped away and scattered across the neighboring farm fields. But the only thing that was left were two interior rooms, the only two interior rooms in the whole place, the bathroom and the mechanical room. And those walls were still standing, and that was all that was left in the concrete slab.
Straight line winds, you don't, that's really dangerous stuff. A tornado is dangerous, obviously, too. But when it comes to straight line winds versus tornadoes, what's the ratio there in any given storm or situation?
Far more injuries occur from downbursts and straight-line winds, ultimately, than from tornadoes. Straight-line winds, as we know, boundary waters blow down. They can blow over 100 miles an hour. And it happens, and they cover large areas of territory, these squall lines, these downbursts, these derechios, and they cause a lot of damage over a much wider geographical area than the typical tornado will.
See, we're talking severe weather, by the way, in the UBS Forum here at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer, along with Paul Douglas, Paul Huttner, and Mark Seeley. We get to talk about Skywarn here in a couple minutes.
I was just going to say, too, and then this is not patronizing, but I have such respect for the Skywarn volunteers. They're not paid. They give up, you know, weekends. They give up countless evenings. And they go out, and unlike storm chasers that get the glory, you know, they get the shot on the Weather Channel. They get paid for great footage. Everybody's after the money shot of the tornado touching down. These guys and gals go out, they're dispatched to a specific location, they sit there, they wait, they know what to look for. They've had hundreds of hours of training, they know what to look for, because in a storm environment, especially at night, it's terribly difficult to know what you're looking at. Is it Virga? Is it a rotating wall cloud? Is it a tornado on the ground? You have to rely on lightning flashes. I mean, it's frightening. It's dirty work many times. And yet, in spite of Doppler radar, if it wasn't for these people on the ground giving us ground truth and validation of what's going on, far more Americans would be losing their lives because of tornadoes. I think the fact that we have such a low death count compared to the number of twisters we see is a credit to Skywarn and law enforcement.
And a person who works with the Skywarn spotters is Todd Krause from the National Weather Service in Chanhassen. How do you all work together? Say, and maybe walk us through a situation where you know that you could have some severe weather popping. How does that whole thing work with your offices and the Skywarn spotters?
Well, it's really a wonderful tribute to the spotters, because they go out when there are storms and they put themselves at risk sometimes. And just last year, there was even a spotter fatality down in Kansas. But there was a great deal of information on a day when there's severe weather. And we would get information to the spotters saying there is severe weather possible later on today. And that gives them a heads up. And then they will go out, and maybe if storms start developing, then there will be a whole network of hundreds or thousands of people out there watching. They get the information back, whether it's by ham radio, cell phone, or what have you. They'll get the information back to the Weather Service so that we, in turn, can get the information out to the general public.
Does that help you? We were talking about this before the show started. Radar detected tornadoes. do they have, what's the high rate of false alarms with those? And then how do the storm spotters then help you out?
The storm spotters help us out because radar is great. We need to know where the storms are. Radar helps us that way. But radar is just a machine. You have to have people out there watching. We can try to estimate whether or not there's a tornado, and that's what we do with those radar-indicated tornadoes. But when people are out there watching, they're looking at the real thing, and we can get that word out to everybody.
Todd, Paul Huttner here. When you weigh in on making a warning, creating a warning for your forecast office, and Craig can weigh in on this too, talk a little bit about the process that starts from the Storm Prediction Center and kind of works its way all the way down to you guys and then with Skywarn, where you're issuing these warnings. What's the big picture on that whole process?
The big picture is sometimes we'll be looking at the potential of severe weather several days ahead of time. I think back to 1998, the day that Comfrey and St. Peter got clobbered. Friday evening, we started getting worried at the weather office and planning for staffing. On Saturday, a moderate risk for severe weather was posted for the very next day. And a very unusual thing, of course, for late March. But that was part of the process, gearing up with staffing, and getting the word out to spotters such that they might need to be ready later on that Sunday.
We have an audience question in the back here, but for our Skywarn spotters, did any of you work the St. Peter Comfrey tornadoes? No? Okay. I was curious as to what that was like to watch that come in from the Twin Cities, from that area as it came through, because that was just an amazing storm.
People were amazed. I mean, there were canceled checks falling down on Eagan from the St. Peter tornado. That was an F3. And I've heard some remarkable stories, some very sad stories. People in Comfrey, which was hit by an F4, an even more powerful tornado, to this day, I think there's some lingering, maybe resentment is too strong a word, but some level of resentment that St. Peter got the coverage, most of the press, many of the recovery dollars, and yet somehow most Minnesotans forgot that Comfrey was hit even worse than St. Peter. So, you know, that's just another thing when talking about trauma and recovery. Yes, the physical recovery can happen in months and years, but These strains can last for decades.
Let's go back into the audience. Hello, your question?
Yes, my name is David James. I'm also a meteorologist. And my question kind of builds on what you've been talking about here. You know, last week there were some pretty bad tornadoes in Virginia, and no one was killed. And I don't think that was luck. I think that has a lot to do with the whole Skywarn, reading the radar, forecasting, and communicating the information. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
David, we were just talking about that. In fact, we talked about it on the podcast this week, and there are some interesting twists with that. First of all, there was very little warning for those tornadoes. The mayor of Suffolk, Virginia, which suffered one of the heaviest concentrations of damage, said they had 3 minutes. The Weather Service did get a tornado warning out for that storm. But as far as we know, there was no tornado watch. These were localized storms. They developed very quickly. And you're right, there were 200 people injured. It's amazing that nobody was killed there. The other angle, and we should talk about how blessed we are here in Minnesota, they don't have sirens down there, and a lot of communities don't. Florida, one city just installed their first tornado sirens within the last year or so here. We are so lucky here in the Twin Cities and much of Minnesota to have the sirens that we have. Even though they're intended as an outdoor warning system, still a lot of people key off of those, and we're very fortunate, I think, to have them.
Kathy, the average lead time, from what I understand, for tornadoes from detection to arrival is about 12 minutes. That's a national average, and that's about double the amount of time 20, 30 years ago. So the Weather Service, new technology, Skywarn, everything working in concert, everything working together, it is making a difference. The problem is Doppler radar shows rotating supercell thunderstorms that you need for a tornado. The problem is only 1 in 4, 1 in 5 of these rotating supercell thunderstorms, these mesocyclones, will ever go on to spawn a tornado. So we are accused, rightfully so, of crying wolf. People say, well, there was a tornado warning for Hennepin County. I never saw one. And here's the thing. 60% of the time when there's a tornado watch, there is at least one tornado touchdown. And so SPC does a very good job early in the day, the Storm Prediction Center, of isolating which parts of which states are under the gun, where the environment is charged and basically on a hair trigger for tornadoes.
Any comments on this, Mark Seely?
Well, I think the legacy of the Weather Service in our state, getting back to Paul Huttner's point, is where we are today is a result of the contribution of many. Since we have Craig Edwards in the room, he's one of them. But also I would salute his predecessors, Joe Strube, Martin Hovde, John Graff. Mm-hmm. The leaders of the Weather Service in Minnesota have been extraordinary citizens, and they've been concerned with safety from the get-go. And I think over time they've nurtured this collaboration and community warning system that we have in play today.
So speaking of Craig Edwards, you're in the front row here. Mr. Edwards, a comment?
Yeah, I think what happens here is now we have set the bar so high now.
Yeah.
And the fatalities have been so minimal that when we do get a fatality, they wonder what happened. How did this possibly happen? And we know from studying tornado statistics, Mark, go back to 65 and the super outbreaks, the devastation of tornadoes can lead to fatalities. I think part of it was luck in the Virginia event. But we have got the bar so high that when we do fail, we feel a lot of angst about that. And I know the Rogers tornado was very troublesome to me. We had a tornado watch out, a severe thunderstorm warning out. The weather radio gone off 3 times to indicate a severe thunderstorm in northwest Hennepin County. My issue that I was dealing with as I was walking out the door was trying to get these false alarms down. Because what I find was happening in the field as I go out and talk to people, the very high-level officials in the government would say, I don't put any credit in those warnings because they're all false alarms. It was if they hear a tornado warning based on Doppler, the indicating rotation, quite honestly, we were looking at 70 to 80% false alarms. That does not build up a case of credibility. We worked very hard on that. And another thing that's happened with the Weather Service, we come up with warning event simulation strategies. We will play back events and what lessons could be learned. And now with archiving the NEXRAD data, we can play a lot of Monday morning quarterback and go back and say, you shoulda, you coulda, you needed to, this is what you should have done when.
Does it work when you go back in Monday morning quarterback?
Oh, yeah, it does for the next time, but it makes the person who was on the radar at the time literally in an operating room trying to juggle all things coming in one way or the other, maintaining situational awareness, and then somebody else coming back and says, yeah, but 5 minutes before that, you should have seen this. Meteorologists are literally looking at MRIs every 6 minutes. You hand one, you look at it, you look at another, and this thunderstorm dynamically is changing in the vertical, changing in the horizontal, morphing, changing all the while. You're trying to maintain situational awareness. All of a sudden, time something pops up in Eau Claire, which is also part of the forecast area. So right. You have a lot of responsibility to look at, and the thunderstorms are evolving and changing. A lot of things go into making a warning decision.
Which leads me to this question, gentlemen. As forecasters, do we rely too much on technology when you're forecasting storms?
I think there can be a tendency to do that. The technology has come so far. When I first interned at WCCO some 20 years ago, we were just transitioning to computers. They literally still had the chalkboard. This was in the early 80s, and they had just put the first Apple computer online to start running weather graphics.
They're going back to the chalkboard.
Oh, that was a cheap shot. I'm sorry.
Paul Douglas.
I meant to think that, not say it. And there are days when I think that might be an improvement. At least that's what some of our listeners and viewers say. But, Craig, to get back to your point, too, about Rogers, and, Paul, I know you were looking at that storm as well, perhaps. That was a very atypical storm. That was not, on radar echoes, a typical hook echo or a tornadic-looking storm. And the irony of that is that the girl who was tragically killed was in the basement of that home at the time.
She did the right thing.
She did the right thing. It happens. We're not going to prevent every death, but what these guys do is nothing short of heroic.
Why was that not a typical hook echo? Was that because of heavy rain or something? What was going on there?
You know, seeing these, and I really want to come back to something Craig said, Craig Edwards from the Weather Service, the situational awareness. You have to keep in mind a meteorologist on duty is like a doctor. Okay, you're looking at symptoms, except you have 30 different patients, okay? You are looking at 30 different thunderstorms, any one of which could spin up a tornado. And so just trying to keep up to the second with live information. Doppler radar is more of a blessing than a curse, but in some respects, I think it gives the illusion. When we give the play-by-play on television and we track the storm and we show you the towns, we tell you what time. First of all, I think it gives people almost a false sense of security. Hey, it's not my town, not my county, I don't care. And the other thing, I think in many cases it traumatizes people that they think there's a tornado around every corner. It's just like when a crime story leads the newscast, you're afraid to walk out in your neighborhood. Okay? I think there's a little some of that going on. When we play up the weather, and rightfully so, on the big severe weather days, the reality is a tornado will affect 1/1,000th of 1% of the state, if that. And yet there's this illusion that there's a tornado around every corner. I just thank God that when it comes to severe weather in this state, everybody speaks with one voice. There is a compelling body of research that shows that if there's conflicting information, people at home are more apt to do nothing. And so I can disagree with my colleagues and what the 7-day forecast is going to be, but when it comes to severe weather, everybody has to issue the same warnings for the same counties. I can maybe disagree and say, here's why I think this cell is more impressive. But if we all start doing our own thing and trying to get a jump because we work in a competitive business,
does
broadcasting,
it happen elsewhere? Other parts
Oklahoma
of the country?
City, they okay. issue their own warnings. I mean, it's anarchy. It is pure anarchy, and I'm not sure the public is well served by that.
Nick Elms?
Well, and stemming off of some of what Craig said regarding the Rogers event in September 06, from a spotter standpoint, you know, as he talks about the meteorologists looking at MRIs and critiquing those, you know, in very short amount of time, lots of challenges were also faced from the spotters in the field that evening. I happened to be coordinating a spotter network in that part of the Twin Cities that night, and many challenges faced. Storms coming through in an unusual time of year, very late at night, under the cover of darkness, and the Jan Asanovas did a very good job on that evening with their performance of handling. So a lot of challenges faced. Also on our panel here tonight, we have another spotter that I worked with that evening who happened to drive through there very close to when the tornado occurred.
Teresa, would you like to go ahead and tell us about that?
Sure. I was driving home from a wedding in Melrose, and I just happened to be driving through some very heavy rain and very strong winds, and I got just west of Rogers, and I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw debris laying all over the road. I saw a sign wrapped around a post, and I knew that something significant had happened. You know, it had looked primarily to be a strong wind event, but also I knew that there was a tornado watch at the time, so I immediately called the weather service and reported the damage as soon as I could, actually, as soon as it was safe enough for me to do so, because there was heavy traffic and a lot of debris on the road.
So we're talking about severe storm detection and safety here in the UBS Forum at Minnesota Public Radio with a panel of experts, Paul Douglas, Paul Huttner, Mark Seeley, Craig Edwards, Todd Krause, Skywarn spotters, and of course we have a full house here, a lot of audience members. Let's go back into the audience for another question. Go ahead.
My name's Judy Chucker. I'm a weatherholic. And my question has to do with your reference earlier to whether or not we have enough, have too much technology. I'm a rabid weather person, and a number of years ago, my friend Mary and myself were stuck in Gabbert's in the mattress section of all places, without windows, no popcorn. I wasn't interested in buying a mattress. I wanted to be by a window to watch what was going on. So this takes me back to when I was just a little kid. I have been interested since then and could always predict when bad weather was coming. It could be early in the morning, and people thought I was crazy, but then they learned to listen to me. And I'm just wondering if there's something to that, if we've lost that. I've lost a little bit of that when I turn to listen to what's going on with the weather predictions. Have you ever heard anything like that? People have that capacity to intuit bad weather?
My wife calls me a weather shaman because I literally still will go outside and I'll take the observation. You know, I'm not the guy in Twister who sniffs the dirt or anything, but I think there is something to be gained from a keen sense of observation. And there are maybe sort of electromagnetic currents that we can sense, or parts of our human body that can sense things. But I do find it valuable to get outside, especially when a storm's coming, and kind of sniff the air. And I do think it helps me at least qualitatively describe the weather every day, which is part of what we do.
I just like to point out my wife calls me something different. But and before we leave tonight, may I have your phone number? Would you mind? I'm open to
anything. You can get a job somewhere is what you can
point.
Do.
Yeah. But I think there's something to that. There's no substitute for common sense, first of all. And I think we can become too dependent on technology. I tell people, if you're reliant on the sirens only, you're stuck. I mean, the sirens, as Paul mentioned,
Most people do, though.
Be heard indoors. People get indignant. I can't hear the sirens inside the hospital. Said you were never meant to hear the sirens. They were meant for outdoor use. And you should have backup plan after backup plan. You should have a safety net of 5 or 6 different sources, everything from alerts on your cell phone to NOAA weather radio, the cheapest $30, $40 life insurance policy you'll ever own, to radio, television, internet. The more safety nets you have layered one after another, the lower the chance that you're going to become a statistic. And I tell people, too, don't thumb your nose at some of the things your grandmother used to tell you growing up. I think we can learn some things from nature.
For instance?
Our bodies are, 85% water?
Right.
And many people swear by the fact that when the barometer is falling rapidly, they feel it in their joints.
Mm-hmm.
Aches and pains, arthritis sufferers, people that suffer from bursitis, recent bone breaks, they swear they know when it's about to rain. And when there's a tornado forming, the pressure is going down in one heck of a hurry. Are dogs and cats affected as they are before earthquakes? I don't pretend to know,
But I think we discount those things at our own peril. I think we need to look at everything.
Quick comment here, Mark Seeley.
In Germany, they call that Wetterschmerz, or weather pains. And I know my wife can. My wife has amplified pain associated with falling low pressure. But there's also, I've read in science that there are also animals that have more acute hearing of low-frequency sound. So from far, far distances where storms are emitting low-frequency sound waves, some animals can actually pick them up way before human beings can.
See, the things you'll learn here in the
it's
UBS Forum.
And yeah. We've all talked about our wives. Do you want to say anything about your husband,
I don't,
Kathy,
thank or? You. I appreciate that, Paul. Thank you. Let's go back in the audience.
Hi, I'm Jean Hildebrandt, and Mark Seeley, my question's for you. I listen to you faithfully on Friday mornings. I arrange my schedule so that I'm available at 6:50 on Friday mornings to hear your comments. But my question is, are we more likely to have tornadoes in an El Nino year versus a La Nina year?
I have not seen evidence to suggest that there's a correlation in Minnesota in terms of those phenomena. So although they studied the heck out of them, you know, they've studied La Nina and El Nino in the context of winter storms, in the context of hurricanes, in the context of a whole range of things. And I haven't seen any evidence specific to Minnesota. We are in a La Nina fade right now. The La Nina episode that's been in play and probably with fairly high certainty has had some impact on our winter season, is starting a slow fade now. So whether it's in play as a reality this summer remains to be seen.
Paul Douglas?
I've seen some evidence from the Storm Prediction Center folks, from Mr. Schaefer down there. He did a paper showing a correlation between La Nina events, cooling events in the Pacific, and a higher incidence of tornadoes downwind, not in Minnesota per se, but more central and southern plain states. So you can make that loose connection. Does it mean more tornadoes are imminent for Minnesota this year? Not necessarily. El Nino, not as much. La Nina years, it seems like there may be a little more of a correlation, a little bit of an uptick in tornadoes. But this is, talk about leading, bleeding edge of the research. 20 years ago, people were not talking even about El Nino. I mean, it's a relatively recent discovery. And yet these El Nino, these oscillations, the Enzo oscillations, go back to the beginning of time. I mean, they've always been around.
One thing I think I would say further, and this gets into a bit of what I teach with school science teachers, is the scientific method is about large populations, large sample sizes. You want to accumulate as much evidence as you can before you test a hypothesis. The difficulty with the ENSO, both the El Nino episodes and the La Nina episodes, in terms of their believability from a scientific standpoint, is strictly sampling size. In the El Nino historical record and La Nina historical record, we have between 25 and 30 cases. 25 and 30 cases and trying to develop meaningful skill from correlations is pretty problematic as a scientific method. If we had 200 cases or 300 cases or something like that. So from a scientific standpoint, it's still difficult for me to fully accept.
And I both agree with what Mark and Paul are saying, and I've seen a little bit of that research that talks about increases for tornadoes in La Nina years, especially in the southern plains in spring. This is a La Nina year. Just so far, I pulled this off SPC today, 694 tornadoes in the United States so far this year, 10-year average about 500. So we are running well ahead of the curve in this La Nina year.
And as Paul said to begin our conversation, Paul Douglas, you think that we're going to see maybe more severe weather this year around here.
I think even, much like this winter, when you look at the entirety of the winter, it wasn't that far off the averages. It's just that we've become so accustomed to wimpy Missouri winters here in Minnesota, the fact that we had a real winter, all of a sudden people are up in arms and indignant. And I think there's going to be some of that. Even if we just bounce back up to normal, 26, 30 tornadoes, that's going to seem like a lot compared to the last few years when we've been in a drought. That's the only silver lining of a drought. You don't have moisture. It's tougher getting tornadoes.
Mark Seeley?
Sorry, headline that you won't see in the newspaper, at least I don't think you will, but was just revealed today in terms of this winter, Paul. And maybe you're aware of this. It was just released this afternoon. New state record April snowfall set this year. Zirkel and Itasca State Park up in Clearwater County in northwestern Minnesota, 43 and 49 inches total for the month of April, obliterated the old state record of 37 inches of snow for the month of April.
That's not fair.
Yeah.
So let me ask you the question that I get asked ad nauseum. Where's your global warming now, Professor Seeley? And the difference between weather and climate, I've implored people to notice the difference between weather and climate. And I know it was a tough winter, especially right. The last half of the winter. Do you care to talk a little bit about the perception, not to look out your window at your thermometer, but more to look at the new kinds of flowers that are growing in your yard and new species of birds that are flying into your yard? That's a better indicator of what's really going on.
My simple answer is that meteorology is a hourly, daily, and perhaps weekly field of view. Climatology is a decade, century field of view. And so you're looking at trends and which direction the patterns seem to be steering. And if we look at this winter as a whole, the winter heating season in Minnesota, the November through March period we just concluded, was 40th in a historical ranking, with 1 being the coldest and 113 being the warmest. So you could say it was slightly over in the cold side of the distribution. But if I'm not mistaken, 9 of the last 11 have been way the heck up in 90, 100, 105, way up near the top of the distribution.
I quote you frequently that something like 7 or 8 of the last Novembers have been warm enough to play golf in Minnesota.
Yes.
And historically, I mean, that is off the scale in terms of unusual.
Yes, and I think I've taken advantage of a few
Have
of
you?
Those. Yeah.
For research. Just for research.
Just for
though,
research.
Right? Yes.
Another audience question. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. My name is Mary, and I wanted to mention one experience that we had in 81 when the tornado came through Minneapolis and ended up in Roseville. And ever since then, I think it was the first year they were using Doppler radar, if I'm not mistaken. And I think ever since then, I've taken storms pretty seriously. The block we were living on got hit, and it was substantial damage from that, even though it was in the city, so it can happen. Mm-hmm. But my question was, again, I kind of have a long-range view of weather and stormy patterns. I think I remember a week or so ago, maybe a little longer than that, there was a weather program on in the morning on NPR, and there was some discussion about storminess going in patterns or cycles over. I can't remember specifically the time periods, but it seemed to me it was every 15 years or every so many years you could see an uptick in the amount of stormy weather, and then there might be some kind of a quieting of that for a while. So I guess I'm directing it to you and asking whether or not you have seen those trends, and if you could elaborate on that.
You're asking me? Okay.
You're the climatologist, the long view.
There we go. Storminess, the frequency of storminess is, in my view, here in the middle of the North American continent, not cyclical, but episodic. If it were cyclical, we could perhaps develop methods to predict it. But it's definitely episodic, and we get these bursts, and sometimes they last a month, sometimes they last a whole season. Sometimes we even get consecutive years. But the degree of variability we have in this is clearly induced by these episodes that we have, where all the ingredients, and the Weather Service has all these ingredients forecasting methods, but where the ingredients, the mix of all the features of the atmosphere that go into producing the storminess, gets in a static pattern and holds over our geographic region for a long period of time. And so in 2001, and Todd and Craig, correct me if I'm wrong, when we had the 74 documented tornadoes in Minnesota in the 2001 season, if we go back and we look at the time course of those 74, they all came in episodes.
Craig Edwards?
Yeah, I think the question comes from Paul and I being on Midday, where we were talking about the episode, and Kenny Blumenfeld, I believe I'm getting his name, he presented a presentation at the workshop for Skywarn recently, and he was talking about the expanding potential for catastrophic tornadoes, particularly as this expanded metropolitan area. And I think the point he was making at the time was the epicidal cycle would be about 15 years. You're looking at, we went through the Palm Sunday thing and then the April 1974 super outbreak. And I think what the issue was that we are about due, and I said that on the show. And I didn't say I'm predicting it, but what I'm hearing from essentially Paul and Mark earlier in the show was we might be due. And coming off of 18 last year, and Todd, I think the year before that was only like 19 or something.
Something like that.
So we were coming off two low years of tornadoes. And if I would have known that, I would have stayed in the weather service business. Because when we have 71 and 50 and 60, and we were leading the nation as a decade changed, that was signaling to me that something was going on with the climate. So when people say, what do you think about climate change? And I said, the 15 years I've been in Minnesota, I've experienced it. So you don't have to tell me about it. And I said, when I retire, I'm going to retire someplace warm. I didn't know I was going to be able to stay in Minneapolis.
Hey, this is kind of a micro question as we're talking about this. When you have a severe storm complex come through an area, and if you do have tornadic activity, can they be in clusters? Is that usually the case? If you happen to have a tornado, do they come in clusters?
Like in families?
Yeah.
Well, frequently the same supercell will evolve. It will drop a tornado, and then it will occlude cooler, rainy air, hail-cooled air will wrap into the center, into the updraft, choke off that storm, and then deeper, just to the south and east in the warm updraft, another supercell, another mesocyclone will develop. And so you can have families of tornadoes, one right after another, going on for hours. I mean, that is seen fairly frequently.
Okay, so that's why it's important when you have a warning, you just stay until the all clear.
And if
together.
It's not your county, even if it's a couple of counties away, you really have to be on alert.
Paul Huttner?
Another thing we see in these outbreaks when supercells form is often the first couple of storms will become tornadic and put down tornadoes. And then it may eventually evolve into a squall line with more widespread downburst winds. But, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong on this, if you've observed it, but often those first couple cells that get going on a severe weather day are often the ones that can become tornadic.
Yeah, they tap the most pent-up energy. It seems like, you're right, the first couple seem to be the worst.
The best storm environment often exists right at the onset of these supercells developing.
And it doesn't have to be in the 70s, 80s, 90s to get a tornado. I mean, the day of the major outbreak, St. Peter, what was it, in the 50s here?
But it was very humid, though. It really was humid, if I recall.
People are always expecting it to be warm and muggy and see that greenish sky. And sometimes that's the case, but not always.
Another audience question. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Carrie from Minneapolis. I hate to distract us from like the excitement of tornadoes and all that thing, and I hate to bring us back to winter, but I really vividly remember the Halloween blizzard, and I'm sure everybody else does here too. Yeah. And it seems like we've kind of been in a lack of big storms here in the Twin Cities. I guess maybe this is a question for Mark. And is that odd? Is it odd to see a pattern of so many years without a lot of snowfall? Especially maybe in terms of like the big, huge storms. And another thing that I'm kind of curious about is we hear a lot about tornadoes and hailstorms, these large thunderstorms, and how they form. But what things come together to create one of these super massive snowstorms that dumps, 20 inches of snow, on us? And what can cause that, and what kind of conditions do we have to have for one of those to happen?
I think I'll take your historical question and pass the second question to my colleagues here. They're probably better prepared to deal with the storm genesis. In the historical context, we're all experiencing this. We all recall those winters where we laid down a swath of snow early. It stayed for the duration of winter. Maybe we had snow after snow after snow. We have such intermittent conditions now that dominate our winter that it's striking. We still get the occasional heavy snow. We still get the occasional 8, 10, 12-inch snowfall. But we lack duration in our winter. Our winter is contracting. And in fact, you'll remember, I can tell from the generations represented here tonight, you'll remember well when March was the snowiest month of the year. March was the snowiest month in Minnesota. Those days are gone. All the recent statistics of the last few decades clearly show January is the snowiest month. And much, if you look at the transitional state we go through every March, you find that a lot of the March precipitation is falling as liquid in a warmer atmosphere. So there's you're hitting on an important trend there. It's interesting that our moisture signal, though, is amplified. If we discount what form the precipitation is and we simply count the liquid precipitation, boy, we're seeing increases in everybody's normal. You can hardly find a community around the state of Minnesota where what they call the historical average precipitation isn't going up.
Yes, go ahead.
This was a very interesting winter for snowfall. As Mark mentioned, we had the record April snows in northwest Minnesota, some areas 48, I think even an unofficial 50 inches around Bemidji. Madison, Wisconsin, 101 inches this winter season, an all-time record for Madison. And here we sit in between with slightly below average snowfall. Now, maybe these guys know a meteorological or climatological reason for that, but I don't know. That, to me, is just one of the beauties and the mysteries of weather this winter season.
I think it's Channel 5's Doppler.
Could be.
I can't prove it. But getting back to your excellent question about why 91, you know, why 30 inches of snow over 3 days, it seems to me like this winter we finally had that high amplitude pattern, okay, with a jet stream howling from Texas, sweeping the Gulf moisture up. Notice I'm gesturing. I'm sorry. Too many years in front of a green screen.
Get the chalkboard back for you.
Something to point to. But think about this. If climate change is in fact a reality, as I think it is, I haven't been shy about, you know, letting people know how I feel about this. You warm up the northern latitudes, and suddenly you don't have the baroclinicity. You don't have these vast contrasts in temperature from north to south across the United States that you did back in the 60s, 70s, even the early 80s. You need that huge temperature contrast. And what you really need for a blizzard, an old-fashioned blizzard, is a fresh supply of Arctic air right at your doorstep, just sitting there across the Dakotas, northwestern Minnesota. And you need that flow coming up from the south, you know, coming up from New Mexico, Texas. And it seems like that setup now is so rare, especially with our winters trending milder. We just don't have that sub-zero air sitting 200, 300 miles to our north and west. So, but again, proving cause and effect, proving anything with the atmosphere is it's a tough one.
See, that was a good question. Snowstorms are severe weather. Yeah. You know, it all is part of the big picture. Let's go back in the audience and take another question.
Hi, my name's Mary. I understood several years ago that our climate with global warming would become like Nebraska, and I took that to mean that it would be warmer and drier. And ever since I'm a gardener, and I've been tending to buy plants that are more drought tolerant. Now, should I keep that up? What is the most recent state we're going to be like? Is it still Nebraska?
I see you've got the Cornhusker red on tonight, so you're good.
Yes.
You're good with that.
Boy, that's such a loaded question. I think Nebraska may be a little a little extreme. Nothing against Nebraska. It's a lovely state. I've been there. Perhaps more like central Iowa. Many of the computer models indicate that we will actually be wetter across much of Minnesota, especially northern and eastern Minnesota, much of Wisconsin. Southwestern Minnesota may trend strongly drier. And just to the south and west, Iowa, the Dakotas, Nebraska, much, much drier. But again, it looks like we're going to be right on that boundary. And a difference of 200 miles either way could make a huge difference. We simply don't know.
Paul Hunter?
Here's the other thing I think to think about and that I've heard discussed is that even though we're going to average milder over winters and over years, we're far enough north latitude that we may still get these extreme bouts of cold in winter. And that could definitely affect the hardiness of what will survive in this climate.
I would add that, and I've said this to Kathy many times on Morning Edition, I hate that analogy. I hate, maybe it's because I covet Minnesota as home so much, but you can't displace Minnesota to Nebraska. Or you can't displace Minnesota to Missouri or whatever. Minnesota as a landscape is a totally unique landscape. 16,000 and some lakes. We've got topography in the northeast, topography in the southeast. We've got prairie in the west. We've got a huge variety of soils, very deep glacial soils in the southern part of the state, very thin soils in the northern part of the state. So the convergence of the atmosphere over us is mixing with and affected by a landscape that is so vastly different than the landscapes south of us, that I just see that interaction giving us a unique signature. And that's the reason I don't like that analogy.
Let's go back into the audience and take one final question here.
Hi. My name's Rick Torney. This is kind of a climate question, and I know we all want to blame ourselves for global warming, but is there really some kind of long-term trend that we're living through? Like, we know that there was an ice age at one time. Are we just experiencing a warming that somewhat is due to not all blamed on us for...
All of the previous warmings that I'm aware of, and I do not pretend to have the answer key, and it was warmer from about 850 AD to about 1200, 1300, but that can be traced to astronomical triggers, literally the orbit of the Earth around the sun. This is the first time that the warming, although most pronounced at the high latitudes, this is the first time the warming is global, and it can't be linked... It can't be tied to specific astronomical triggers, changes in the Earth's orbit. So superimpose that with the fact that there's been a 38% uptick in greenhouse gases, and it's either the mother of all coincidences or there's some sort of linkage. And I think to pretend otherwise is
Dr. Seeley?
Dangerous.
I was just at a conference in Washington, D.C. addressing this issue, and... The majority scientific view is that there are three drivers to the Earth climate system's behavior. There's natural variation, which Paul Douglas just described. But then there's two other drivers that are related to the human species. We disturb the landscapes we occupy, and we disturb the landscapes we exploit for their resources. In disturbing those landscapes, we disturb the interaction of that landscape with the overlying atmosphere. And that has measurable effect. In fact, there's multiple research papers that document that. We also change the composition of the Earth's atmosphere by what we put into it. So two of the three drivers of the Earth climate system are us. The climate modelers then look at, just as Paul was describing, they'll look at how well they can mimic the behavior of the Earth climate system today by just using natural drivers, and they don't do as well as they do when they include the human disturbance. So that tells you right there that the human side of it is driving at least a good fraction of it. And so we need to accept that and think about the implications and to what degree we can adapt or mitigate our environment rather than just continue on and ignore it. And so that's kind of what fundamentally is going on.
See, before we go,
I'm curious, because you all are very steeped in technology. When we talk about storm detection, is there something on the horizon, some really interesting, new, spiffy kind of technology that will really help in storm detection at all that you're seeing on the horizon? Anything out there? Or just...
Paul, have you invented anything yet?
I'm tired. No, I mean the whole cell phone thing. That was my last adventure, and I'm still looking for what comes next. I think what's fascinating to me is what's happening with social networks, the Facebooks and the MySpaces, and as we create these rich real-time networks of people that we can actually exploit, not only the technology, but people. Imagine you've got 5 million Skywarn spotters, or 10 million in real time twittering back and forth. I think we've just seen the tip of the iceberg.
Twittering about storms?
Twittering. You don't Twitter?
I do not Twitter.
You don't Twitter?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm a technological Luddite. I apologize.
Twittering, I'm not even sure what that is, but it sounds,
sounds
cool,
good.
Doesn't it? Something you tell people more than they really wanted to know about what you're doing right now. In real time, and you can follow what your friends
so
are doing.
So really, you can say, if I see a storm coming, I can Twitter my friend and say...
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So I think there's some way to leverage the human potential and not put all our eggs in the technology basket.
Thank you, Paul Douglas. Storm spotter over here.
Yeah, one thing I just wanted to mention as far as new technology coming, I think the number one thing we don't talk about is how the communications infrastructure has changed the warnings, changed forecasts. It used to be, you know, you look back to the super outbreaks and you heard about it, you read about it in the paper the next day, whereas now Twittering, you know, instant messaging, all of these communication things that can happen to learn about it before, you know, the 12-minute lead time, all of the technology from the Weather Service. Instead of reading about it in the paper the next day, just the instant communications infrastructure.
Todd Krause from the National Weather Service, can you answer my question about technology?
Well, there are a few additional radars that are being worked on. There's something that the Navy has had for years and years called the phased array radar, and now that's being experimented on down in Oklahoma with regard to storms. Another thing that they're doing is they can have little, almost like toy Doppler radars, on cell phones every 20 and 30 miles. And these little radars get plopped on the towers, and they've got great networks where they can see the fine scale details of storms. So those are some of the technological things that are going on.
Do they take Visa?
He wants one.
I need one of those. That will complete me if I have one of those.
Christmas is coming. And they might
They're
be affordable.
Portable, really?
Who knows?
The neighbors won't mind.
See, before we go, I have to ask you this. In each, go out right down the line here. Why are we so fascinated by storms?
They define us. I mean, I tell people, and it's true, we live in the Super Bowl of weather. It does not get any more interesting, extreme than it gets here in Minnesota. I think it's brought out the best in us. We've had to be ingenious as a state to not only survive, but thrive. And it really has made Minnesota what it is today in terms of the work ethic. We do have something fragile in this state, that quality of life. And believe me, having lived in Chicago, having grown up out east, that quality of life, it's real.
Paul Huttner? Or are we so fascinated?
It's just the adrenaline rush for most of us. You know, everybody remembers a big storm. Having spent, you know, 20 years in the business answering telephones in the weather office, everybody remembers that one big storm. And I think they're memorable. They just stick with us, and that awesome force of nature kind of blocks everything else out. All the noise disappears when a big storm moves in. And one of the things I love about Minnesota, especially in severe weather situation and winter storms, is how we pitch in and we become neighborly. We help each other out. And I think that's one of the things that I take away from one of the benefits, one of the good sides of severe weather.
Mark Seeley?
It's our common ground. My heart was warmed by the 10th anniversary of the tornado and the celebration in St. Peter at the community center this year, simply because 2 weeks before Easter in 1998, That tornado destroyed both the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church. They held a joint Easter Sunday service, and every year since that time, those congregations have gotten together to worship and picnic together, and so it's a unifying effect.
Well, I'm an admitted weather geek, you all know that, and I'm fascinated by the subject, so I have had a wonderful time listening to all of you in the UBS Forum for this special conversation on severe weather. Thanks to our special guests, Paul Huttner, Paul Douglas, Mark Seely, Todd Krause, Craig Edwards, the crew from Metro Skywarn, and of course, thanks to our audience. And for more weather information, including our Jet Streaming podcast, check out MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. I'm Kathy Werzer. Thank you so much for joining us.